Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel. The all-new Opel Mokka. With a new visor front face and pure panel interior, this is Opel.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
All right, I hope insomnia got you into the mood for the weekend. And another reminder that the weekend is upon us is that it is Friday, the Friday Gathering. And we have in studio here Brenda Power, columnist with the Irish Daily Mail and the Sunday Times, Paul Murphy, People Before Profit TD for Dublin Southwest, and Robert Troy, Minister of State at the Department of Enterprise, Trade, Employment, and of course Fianna Fáil TD for Longford Westmeath. Welcome one and all. Minister, can I talk to you about this pollster story? Have you ever asked any of your team to canvass for opinions in this way?
Truthfully, yes. On one occasion back a number of elections ago, we conducted a poll in Mullingar on the basis to see whether we'd run two or three candidates in a particular local electoral area. We did not impersonate any polling company. We went around with a sample ballot paper, got the views of...
But did they know you were from Fianna Fáil?
Well, they didn't ask. And the guidance of them today was, if asked, they were there collecting.
Well, how would you have introduced yourself? Because I think we do understand the importance of polling and sussing out how many candidates we should run or whether somebody is going well or not. That's understandable. I suppose the problem is if you don't identify yourself or if you masquerade as somebody that you're not. So how would you or your people have identified yourselves?
But let's be clear, we didn't pretend we were somebody else. We went to the doors and we asked that we were... Would they mind participating in a sample poll? The poll was of a political nature and to ascertain their voting intentions in the upcoming local election.
What did you tell them? What did you say when you knock on the door?
They're here doing carrying out a poll.
Yeah.
The poll is of a political nature. We're here to ascertain your voting intentions in the upcoming local election.
But if you were asked for your ID, which a lot of people do, ask for ID when somebody, a stranger, knocks on their door, would you...
Nobody was requested an ID on that occasion. And if asked...
Asked who you were?
No, nobody. I didn't participate in it.
No one asked who they were.
They conducted, I think, about 40 houses in total. It was a very small sample. But I think that the key issue here is it was to ascertain, in terms of the political voting intentions of a particular area, no personal data was collected and no personal data was retained. It was a sample poll, a snapshot in time, checking the mood of the electorate in that particular area.
Anything underhand about doing it that way?
Look, it wasn't good practice. It was bad practice. And I think a number of my colleagues who have been out this week, I myself was out earlier on in the week and said it was bad practice and that's why it was discontinued. Right. It hasn't happened for a long number of years. Most political parties are using the professional polling companies to do a better job. It's much better practice. And we shouldn't have done it, and that's the bottom line of it.
Paul Murphy, you're relatively new to People Before Profit, and then they get mixed up. I don't mean to be flippant about it, but with the number of different splinters on the left. But when you were with the Socialist Party, for example, did you carry out polling in this manner?
Yeah, I've done polling, and I don't think there's anything wrong with political parties conducting polling if it is done on the basis of being fully anonymised, if no data is kept on who is telling you what information, instead you get the overall polling picture. But opinion polling is valuable, right? It gives you a picture of the constituency.
So when you say your canvassers or your supporters, how would they have done this sort of polling?
In a similar way to what Robert is...
Just knock on the door.
You knock on the door, you're saying you're doing a poll... You give people the ballot paper, they fill it out. If they ask who you're from, what you'd say is, look, I can tell you who I'm from, but if I tell you on which party I'm conducting this, then we won't be able to complete the poll because it would skew it.
Right.
But what we would do in those circumstances, very few people ask is the truth, but in those circumstances where people did, say, I can tell you at the end of the poll if you'd like, if you want to, or I can
and
tell you
any
now.
Other
and
data, any other data
no,
collected?
No other data. And the point being that... Like, nobody is raising any problem right now with paying for constituency polling, right? And constituency polling is expensive.
Yes.
It's many, many
thousands
of euros.
So that's what I'm just wondering. Do you employ, or does people before profit. Do you employ polling, professional polling companies? Because Sinn Féin's answer the other day was, we were a poor party back then and we couldn't afford it. Now,
so people before, like you say, I've only joined People Before Profit in the last number of months. Yeah. They have never done this. They haven't paid for it and they haven't done it themselves. But I don't think there's anything wrong with a party which is a small and relatively poor party compared to
the big parties. So you disagree with Robert Troy in terms of he thinks it's bad practice?
I don't think there's no qualitative difference between a party which has the money saying we're going to pay 10 grand to go to a polling company. Those pollsters will go on the door and they also will not say what party they're conducting the polling for, because to do so would skew the results of the poll. So there's no fundamental difference between them doing it and volunteers.
And what
doing
about
it.
What
and
about
it means that the smaller parties can get access to that sort of information.
What about the idea of inventing a polling company to do it?
Yeah, certainly.
Sinn Féin and Dublin West.
I agree that is bad practice. Certainly the fake IDs, all of that stuff. That isn't good practice. I agree with that, and that's not something that we would have done.
Okay, Brenda Power, I have two texts in here. One is from Mike in Westport. The polling story is a typical media storm in a teacup. The general public don't give a damn how parties get their information. So that's Mike in Westport. But then Tommy says, you can dress it up any way you want, but this was deception carried out on a large scale by many political parties, a plague on all their houses. Where do you fall in this?
Yeah, I mean, it's not ideal, is it? The method that Paul has outlined there would sound to me to be the way that was always available to rich or poor parties to go about, say, look, I'm conducting a poll, I'd prefer not to tell you who it's for, and I'll give you a heads up at the end. The idea of conducting surveys with fake lanyards and fake ID, you know, I'm from the Acme polling company, where in fact you're from Sinn Féin or from Fine Gael, that is not going to do anything for the status of politics in this country. It's going to feed into every conspiracy theories about how do you trust anyone with an official looking document.
But was it done innocently at the time, do you think?
Do you have to be to sit down and make up a name, make up a logo, make up get these things laminated and hand them out
disguise themselves
It's not much I agree with Paul on, but I think in fairness the method that he has outlined there sounds to me like if somebody came to my door and said, I'm conducting a poll, the first thing I would say was, and I'm surprised that Robert has found people so lax with their personal safety and their personal details or even their voting intentions, because we know now that these are items that people can be used and trawled for personal details to maybe unlock your bank account.
If someone knocked on my door and said,
you know, I'm conducting a poll, I would say, who are you from? Have you got an ID? Who are you? I mean, I know that these were a few years ago and we have become much more alert to scams and so on. I'm not doubting Robert for a moment, but I'd be surprised if people didn't say, well, who are you from? And so the answer would seem to me to say, look, I'd rather not say. If you don't want to participate in those circumstances, you know, that's fine. I mean, on the other hand, I have sympathy with the parties. They do need to know. They may not have had the money. And also you're sending out maybe young pollsters who are volunteers or on low wages, oftentimes perhaps to take dogs abuse on the doorstep if they're a party that the householder may not necessarily
support. Minister, it's an expensive business, obviously, employing polling companies. Now, if you do that, you replicate it around every constituency in the country and among all of, I suppose, your prospective candidates as well, and in branches and so on. It can certainly become very expensive. So, like Paul Murphy is saying there, there's nothing wrong with it to do it using your own members as you did in the past, which you say is bad practice.
Well, I think it's better that we use a polling company. I think it's more accurate. It gives a better reflection of what's happening on the ground.
Is it prudent spending?
I think it can be, because in certain situations, candidates, we've ran too many candidates in some constituencies, which has cost us a seat, and ran too few candidates in other constituencies where we've lost seats. So it is important to know the mood of the nation in terms of candidate selection. I just make a point to Brenda. We did not take anybody's names or addresses. So we weren't collecting anyone's personal data.
No, but you were at somebody's door. You know,
yes.
So you had their address immediately.
Yeah, but we didn't collect it, and we didn't take their name, and the information that was gathered that evening and was shredded. So that's why I feel people didn't have an objection to participate, and some didn't want to participate, and you simply move on to five doors down because it's a random selection. But I think where I think the big issue is people who generated fictitious ID cards. That's what was wrong here. And personally, I thought the days of doing fake ID was when you were 16 or 17 to get into your local disco, rather than going around getting political information. But I think, you know, people have acknowledged that was wrong. They've learned from it, and I think we need to move on. But political polling is an essential part of the political process.
Gobby, with the days when you would know a house what way they were going to vote and you just wouldn't bother going near there. That was especially the case in rural Ireland. Yeah. Anyway, Paul Murphy, the government this week, Cabinet, have decided to extend, I suppose, supports, if you want to call it that, a protection for renters in the current climate. Do you welcome the measures that they have extended this week?
I mean, they're better than nothing. They're not that much better than nothing, is the truth, right? So, say in terms of this 8% issue, which we highlighted in the Dáil a number of weeks ago, the fact that many hundreds of thousands of people could be facing rent increases of up to 8% because of how the rent freeze was done. And they said, oh, we're going to deal with this. Don't worry, we're going to deal with this to try and dampen down the pressure on it. And they've introduced this measure, which will not deal with it. Of hundreds of thousands of private rented tenants in the country, a few hundred will get protection under this measure. Even those few hundred can be facing rent increases of 12% by the time we get to next year. Like the people I've spoken to, and I've spoken to many people who are facing, you know, rent increases, 150, 160 euros a month. The average in Dublin would be 140 euros a month. They're not protected by this because you have to have filled out a particular form. You have to have lost income due to COVID particularly. And the idea that people can be affording to pay 8% extra when rents are already the fifth highest in Dublin across Europe.
Do you have any sympathy, though, for landlords, investor landlords? It's a very pejorative word, kind of, because a landlord could be somebody that owns a block of flats, or it could be somebody that just invested and took out a mortgage on an investment property. And those people are obviously in a situation where they have bank repayments to make as well. So do you have any sympathy for them as well, that they have also kind of suffered in an individual level?
Yeah, I do have sympathy on an individual level for, like, you know, genuinely small landlords who are caught in situations that they don't want to be in. The overall picture is a picture of the amount of money going to landlords over the past 10 years in this country has doubled. So for 10 billion a year at this point in time, a huge percentage, for example, 40% of HAP payments, so that's state payments for people to assist people with paying their rent, are going to corporate landlords at this stage. So they're getting a huge benefit from the state. And the rental laws in this country, the laws around renting, are stacked still massively in favour of landlords and against tenants. Absolutely, compared to other European countries.
You see, I think most landlords, and I'm not a landlord, I never have been, but I think most landlords would say that the opposite was the case. Certainly, anybody I know who has a small property to rent, maybe something that they were left by a parent or whatever, has very quickly gotten out of the market, because they feel that they are absolutely on the back foot all the time with tenants and their rights. And I think we have a narrative in this country, really, which has emerged that everybody is renting because they simply cannot afford to buy. And in other European countries, there is a rental class, and householders who rent are seen as being on the exact same footing in every way as householders, and they're making a choice. They are absolving themselves of any responsibility for upkeep, maintenance, property tax, whatever. And some people choose to live like that. Here we tend to see renters as a disadvantaged class, and the corollary of that then is that landlords have to be the advantaged class, and that every possible alteration in the law has to come down hard on landlords. A friend of mine worked for a long time in lettings, and if she is ever asked by anybody, look, I have a bit of property, or my parents have died and they left me, should, whatever you do, don't rent it out, because you will never have a minute's peace. And you know, once you proceed with that narrative, what you're inevitably going to end up with is a big investor class who don't give a damn about their tenants, and you're going to end up with, you know, a very uneven situation. I do think that we need to look to the rights of landlords as well. And while I agree that for instance this new regulation, which will ban anything in excess of, I think, 2 months rent in advance or a month deposit and a month rent, that's fair enough. But on the other hand, I've heard tales of landlords being left with tens of thousands of euros worth of damage and unpaid rent. You know, so there are two sides to the coin, is all I'm saying. And if you emphasise endlessly the rights of one category, you inevitably disadvantage the other.
And Paul Murphy, we did hear during the week as well from texters to the programme when we discussed this, that in other European countries, in Amsterdam and in Germany, for example, that landlords demand 3-4 months up front.
Okay. In Ireland, you have a huge issue with landlords wrongly retaining deposits. Obviously, there's cases where they rightly retain the deposits, but say Threshold would say 1 in 5 of every case that they deal with, and a huge percentage of cases at the RTB are based, and I'm sure people know anecdotally, tenants who come to the end of their tenancy have to leave, and the landlord says, oh no, look, there's a nail in the wall. I'm keeping all of your, let's say, 3 months' deposit. So there's a huge abuse that goes on at the moment. So it's welcome that this has been introduced in terms of the maximum of a month and a month. But the other thing that really needs to be done, and it's been passed, interestingly, I mean, it was passed through the Dáil in 2015. It's waiting to be commenced, is a deposit retention scheme, which again would exist in most European countries, whereby the deposit would stay with an independent person. Instead of you giving the money to the landlord, and the landlord gets to decide whether they give it back or not, and if they don't, you have to go through this process in the RTB. Instead, it goes to an independent adjudicator.
What do you think of that, Minister?
Well, look, I think what was done this week is welcome. It gives protections for tenants who were affected by COVID-19, who have lost their job and as a consequence of that are unable to pay their rent. One point I'd make is in relation to tenants who did lose their job during COVID-19, there was a COVID rent allowance scheme introduced to help people pay their rent, to protect them, because people need security of tenure. I agree with the fact that it's very welcome, obviously, that, you know, 1 month's deposit and 1 month upfront, particularly from a student's perspective, because what we saw during COVID-19 was many students who go to college away from home, beginning of September, there's a requirement for them to pay rent up until December. And what happened as a consequence of COVID, many of them were not taking up their rental properties, moved back home, looked for reimbursement. It didn't happen. It was preventing, in some instances, students the opportunity for going to college. So I think the legislation that's going through this, that was announced this week, is welcome, and it's going to give protection to tenants.
Brenda?
Yeah, no, I mean, students obviously are a particular area of concern. I mean, we've come across cases in the last while of students renting camper vans or buying camper vans because they cannot afford to rent in Dublin, basically living in their cars. I mean, that is absolutely inexcusable. I mean, I know, having been a student and a student renter myself, that you know, there wasn't, I know Paul will not agree with me on this, but there was not a whole lot wrong with bedsits in their day, and at least they filled a need. Since they went, there's been a huge want of some sort of alternative for students that is affordable, not, you know, the lap of luxury, because we never expected that, but there's nothing that filled that gap.
And Paul Murphy, another decision made at Cabinet this week was to extend sick pay to members of people in the workforce that weren't afforded it up until here. Again, something you obviously would welcome. Probably, you will say, better late than never.
Yes, and again, I mean, it took a pandemic, like a global pandemic, for them to introduce what is extremely basic, from, again, in most European countries. And the way they're introducing it, it's extremely minimal. So from a number of different points of view, if you look, by 2025, people will be entitled to 10 days, 2 weeks of sick pay. In many other European countries, people get 6 weeks, 2 months, 6 months, a year. So it's extremely, like, small amounts. People obviously can be sick for quite a long time. And
in a lot of countries, they work longer hours as well, though.
I'm not sure that's accurate. Relative to the average working hours in Ireland will be higher than the EU average. I'd be fairly certain of that. But at the end of that 2 weeks as well, you will then go back down to, like, the €203 payment. There's no step down kind of payment, which again would exist in other European countries.
Another but it major is a step flaw, in the right direction, you would agree.
It's a step in the right direction.
Begrudgingly giving credit.
I mean, the other major problem is that you have to be working for the employer for 6 months to qualify. And that is an incentive to keep people on temporary contracts, to swap people over. Yeah. Young people in particular will be badly hit by that.
It's the bare minimum again, Minister.
I think what this is fair and proportionate and balanced. Like, ultimately, the costs associated with this scheme is going to fall on business. It's going to, not just on multinationals, on small, medium-sized enterprises. They're after coming through a horrendous 14, 15 months trading through COVID. Thankfully, the government and the state was able to support them through that period. But they're going to now have to make this pay over a period of the next 3 years. So I think it's right and proportionate that it's been introduced on a phased, gradual basis.
Doesn't it reflect poorly, though, on Fianna Fáil that it's taken to now and the Taoiseach to actually introduce this? Why has Paul Murphy said, why has it taken a global pandemic for something like this to actually happen?
Well, it's the government that has introduced it. It's a whole of government decision, and we're a member of that government, and I'm a junior minister in the department that's introducing it. And yes, the COVID did highlight the need for this. It was critically important from a public health perspective that people don't feel the need that they have to go into work when they're sick, and it's something positive that's coming out of it. We should welcome that, not knock it. And the other point I'd make in relation to, you know, after 2025, they're only entitled to 10 sick days. It's 10 days at 110 euros, and you will have the illness benefit to fall back on as well. So there are critical supports being put in place for employees. But we also have to remember that we need to support businesses, because without sustainable businesses, there will be no jobs.
Well, the only thing I would say is, as a self-employed person for most of my life, I can only look enviously at the prospect of having 10 days fully paid leave, sick leave a year. I suppose, you know, what the need for this was highlighted throughout the pandemic, Damien, by reason of the fact that you had people in poorly paid jobs in meat factories or whatever, who had no entitlement to sick pay, who were taking paracetamol before they went to work to mask the symptoms, and the virus was spreading. So obviously there is a need for sick people, genuinely sick people, to be able to take time off. I'm not actually entirely sure that I think from the outset they need a doctor's note from day one. Mm-hmm. Again, I think that's going to discourage people who simply have, you know, symptoms. And okay, I wouldn't be able to take a day off with symptoms, but we now know how I suppose, transmissible all kinds of very devastating diseases are. Flus and colds cost a lot of man hours every year. So, I mean, I'm not entirely convinced by that. But on the other hand, I have to say that, you know, knowing people, let's say, in jobs where sick pay is an accepted and almost a perk of their existence, that they do tend to talk about, I have a few sick days left to take this year.
It's
and
abuse.
I'd very much like to see that not become a feature of
okay.
this new
All right. Now, we had a special series of reports on the mica and pyrite problems in Donegal and Mayo, which we've been highlighting during the week. I want to get your thoughts on this, but we're just going to take a quick break first.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1. Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
And listeners will have heard during the week our reports, Barry Lenehan in Donegal and Mayo speaking to householders up there whose houses are falling apart because of mica and pyrite in Mayo. Minister, the government is steadfast in saying that they are going to fund 90% of the rebuild costs, but not 100%. Should it be 100%?
Well, what the government has done is they have engaged extensively with the groups that are affected. As late as yesterday, the Taoiseach was in Donegal with Minister McConnell Ogue. Minister O'Brien has met with the mica representative group again, with Dara Cailleary from Mayo. They have asked them to identify where the weaknesses are in the current grant scheme. That document came into the department 5 weeks ago. It's not just the Department of Housing. It's a collaborative approach, housing, finance, deeper.
Yeah, I know, but just the question is, should it be 100%? Because the weakness is that it's 90%.
It's under review.
But what's your own opinion? Do you think they should get 100%?
Well, what I would like to see...
falling down?
What I would like to see is that these affected people are supported. In certain instances, they need to be able to move out of the house now because they're in such a precarious situation.
100%?
Yes.
Does it set a precedent, though, which the country can't afford?
There already is a precedent of the pyrite scheme in terms of Dublin and Leinster. This is, you know, no fault whatsoever of the homeowners. No one's suggesting that it's their fault. And it's a huge amount of money. It isn't even just the 10%, because there's also a cap. So there's a cap of just under 250,000 euros, whereas the cost of placing...
That's a big house in
this,
the countryside.
But the cost of fixing this can be 350,000 euros plus. People can be left with a 100,000 euro bill. And even before they get to that stage, they have to fork out themselves to get the report done, which could be 5,000 or 6,000 euros, which again is an obstacle to people even accessing the scheme. So, I mean, the solution here is simple. The government can act in advance of what is going to be a very large protest, I would say, next Tuesday, and say we're going to do 100% because that's what's necessary.
Brenda?
I'm sure there are people listening who are saying, why are we paying 1%? I mean, these were private homes that were built and bought privately. And I mean, lots of people suffer.
Are you saying
injury.
Tough luck?
Well, I'm not saying that. I'm saying there are probably people who may well think that. But I mean, on the one hand, there are lots of people who suffer injury, Damien, who don't have anybody to claim against because it's not anybody's fault. And I suppose what puzzles me is, if I hired somebody to build me a house and they use bricks which apparently crumble like Weetabix if you drop them, I would have a very definite legal recourse. And I guess that's as far as we can go, because we don't know, you know, where the fault lies here. But, you know, I may be going out on a limb by saying it should have been obvious that these bricks were not the most stable when they were being put in place. No, so somebody is to blame, and the taxpayer is going to pick up the bill.
Right.
I
hope you're not going to Attle or Bundoran on your holidays anyway, Brenda, this summer. Listen, we're going to leave it there. Thank you all for coming in. Enjoy the sunshine out there. Paul Murphy, Brenda Power and Minister Robert Troy, thank you very much for coming in.
Today with Clareburn. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player app.